be that you've never set foot in a courtroom, but know this, that while you may never be on trial, if you're a Christian, you can expect to experience trials because of who and what you represent. Find out how to prepare on today's Grace to You. Years ago, a pastor of a house church overseas was told of being thrown in prison and being physically abused so many times that he lost count. Yet, an official government document at the time said that despite being arrested and, quote, educated many times, this pastor's heart has not died and his nature has not changed. That's what you call knowing victory in the face of persecution or having faith through the fire. And that happens to be the title of John MacArthur's current study here on Grace to You, Faith Through the Fire. And that's what we're helping you prepare for, the heat of the persecution and how to stand strong no matter what. Join us in 1 Peter chapter 4 today and follow along as John MacArthur introduces today's lesson.
On July 19th, in the year 64 AD, Rome burned while Nero fiddled. That's sort of a famous point in history. Everybody remembers that Rome burned and Nero fiddled, but that has significant impact on the writing of this epistle. Let me give you a little background. The great city of the ancient world was consumed that day in an unbelievable holocaust of fire. Rome was a city of very narrow streets. It was a city of high wooden tenements. They built what would today be known as apartment houses out of wood, and they were very close together. The fire spread fast, and although it began on that day, it lasted 3 days and nights, and it broke out again and again, even though they tried to check it. The Romans actually believed that Nero was responsible for burning their great city and their homes. Why? Because Nero had this strange fixation with building. And he wanted to build a new city, and so they believed that he burned down the old one. He stood in the Tower of Maecenas and watched gleefully as the city burned to the ground. In fact, it is said that he was charmed by the loveliness of the flames. People who put the fire out or tried to put it out were hindered by his soldiers and new fires were started. The people were absolutely devastated. They lost everything. The Temple of Luna, the Ara Maxima, the Great Altar, the Temple of Jupiter, the Shrine of Vesta, their homes, all their household gods, everything was gone and they were homeless. The resentment obviously was great. The bitterness was deep and somewhat deadly, and so Nero needed to divert the attention away from himself. He needed a scapegoat, so he selected a scapegoat, the Christians. Publicly, he blamed the Christians for burning Rome. It was an ingenious choice, frankly, on his part, because the Christians were already the victims of hatred and already the victims of slander. They were connected with Jews in the minds of most people who had been dispersed in the diaspora. And since there was a rather growing anti-Semitism, it was easy to have an anti-Christian attitude as well. The Lord's Supper, which Christians held, was closed to pagans. And so they sort of developed all kinds of strange imaginations about what happened. They heard about these Christians who were eating flesh and drinking blood and accused them of cannibalism. In fact, they began to say that they ate babies and Gentiles at the Lord's Supper. They also said that the Christian kiss of love, which supposedly was used at their love feast, was really a demonstration of this unbridled lust and orgy that took place called the Lord's Supper. Christians were also very unpopular because they split families. When a man became a Christian and his wife did not, it was an obvious fracture, and the same would be true in reverse. Christians also used to talk about a time when the world would be dissolved in flames, and so it would be easy to blame them for this fire, thinking they had tried to develop a fulfillment for their own prophecy. And historians tell us that even though there were in Rome some judges who were honest enough and prepared to acquit the Christians of this baseless charge, those judges were overpowered and ignored. Christians were incendiary. Christians were anarchist. Christians were guilty of hatred against civilized society. This really began what later developed into a full-blown persecution. If you go later than Nero to Domitian, Trajan, and the other Roman emperors, you find that what began here as an initial hatred of Christians became a fixed policy. And the question whether a man was a Christian became the most essential part of any charge against him. As a result of this accusation, persecution began. Tacitus, the Roman historian, reported that Nero rolled Christians in pitch or oil and then set fire to them while they were still alive and used them as living torches to light his garden parties. He served them up in the skins of wild animals to his hunting dogs to tear them to shreds. They were nailed to crosses, etc., etc. Christians perished in a delirium of savagery at that time, and even lynching became very common. Within a few years, Christians were imprisoned, racked, seared, broiled, burned, scourged, stoned, and hanged. Some were lacerated with hot knives, and others thrown on the horns of wild bulls. Dr. H.B. Workman, in his chapter, Caesar or Christ, from a very interesting volume called Persecution in the Early Church, wrote this: "For 200 years from Nero on, the leaders among the Christians were branded as anarchists and atheists and hated accordingly. For 200 years, to become a Christian meant the great renunciation, the joining of a despised and persecuted sect, the swimming against the tide of popular prejudice, the coming under the ban of the empire, the possibility at any moment of imprisonment and death under its most fearful forms. For 200 years, he that would follow Christ must count the cost and be prepared to pay the same with his liberty and life. For 200 years, the mere profession of Christianity was itself a crime. Christianus sum was almost the one plea for which there was no forgiveness. In itself, all that was necessary on the back of the condemned as a title. For the name itself, in periods of stress, not a few, meant the rack, the blazing shirt of pitch, the lion, the panther, or in the case of maidens, an infamy worse than death." End quote. Now, what is interesting about that in relation to 1 Peter is that from the best that we can ascertain, this letter was probably written just after that all began. Sometime toward the end of that same year, 64 AD. So it would be written then at a time when Christians were undergoing the beginnings of the horrors of a 200-year persecution. As we look then at verse 12, and I'll call your attention to it, we are not shocked, therefore, to read the words of Peter: "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you." Now, as we approach this text, Peter then is going to draw their attention to the recurring theme of this epistle, and that is the Christian's response to suffering. The Christian's response to suffering. And he gives them four key features in a proper response. And if we can get a grip on these, it'll go a long way to helping us deal with suffering for righteousness' sake in our own lives. Peter tells them, basically, four things are necessary if you are to be triumphant in a fiery ordeal. Number one, expect it. Number two, rejoice in it. Number three, evaluate its cause. And number four, commit yourself to God. Expect it, rejoice in it, evaluate its cause, and entrust yourself to God. Now, this, in a way, sums up all of the instruction in this epistle heretofore along the lines of suffering. Much has already been said. Let's jump right in and take that first point. We find it in verse 12. "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you." The point here is to expect suffering. Expect it. Don't be surprised at it. Don't think it's some strange thing. expect it. Peter has consistently, through this epistle, said that persecution for the Christian in various forms is inevitable. It is inevitable. In fact, the surprise would be if it didn't come. Do not marvel, said John in 1 John 3:13, brethren, if the world hates you, don't be surprised. In John 15 and 16, Jesus said, they hated me, they're going to hate you. Paul, writing to Timothy, says, all that live godly in this present age will suffer persecution, 2 Timothy 3:12. And so Peter is really echoing the instruction of the others who have written in the New Testament that we're not to be surprised when suffering comes. Godly lives lived in an ungodly world confront that world, and we become a kind of unwelcome conscience that is distasteful. And if we name the name of Christ loudly enough, we become offensive. The goodness alone of a Christian can be an offense to a wicked world. And when you add to that the proclamation of the name of Christ, we become particularly offensive. It's as if Peter is saying, suffering is the price of discipleship. Certainly, Jesus had that in mind when he said, you're not going to become a Christian, are you, without counting the cost. Nobody even builds a tower without counting the cost. No general goes to war without counting the cost and assessing his troops and his ability to deal with the enemy. And you certainly wouldn't be so foolish as not to realize that when you become a Christian, you take up a cross, and a cross speaks of pain and suffering and even death. There is definitely a price to pay, because if you name the name of Christ, you will become a conscience to an evil world, which does not welcome such a conscience. Now, it is inevitable that a faithful Christian will suffer some persecution, and that's what he's talking about. He's talking about suffering for righteousness' sake, or suffering because you're a Christian, or suffering because you proclaim the name of Christ. Now, let's go back to our text. Starts by saying, beloved, literally, beloved ones, and he is being very pastoral here. But he's also introducing a new section. The second section in the epistle began in chapter 2, verse 11, with the word beloved. And now the third section and last one begins in chapter 4, verse 12, with the same word beloved. It does introduce the final section, but it is a pastoral word. It is a word of tenderness. It is a word of compassion. It is a word of affection. It is a word of care. You remember back in chapter 1, verse 22, that Peter talked about a sincere love of the brethren. Then in chapter 4, verse 8, he talked about the fact that we are to keep a fervent love for one another because love covers a multitude of sins. Well, here he's exhibiting that compassion, that fervent love, that intense love, as he speaks of these believers in this gracious term. It is a reminder that they are loved by Peter, and more than that, they are loved by God. That, my dear friends, is a sweet pillow to rest your weary soul on in the midst of persecution. You are still the beloved of God. You are still the beloved of a Christian brother. I suppose it would be a temptation in the midst of suffering, in the midst of temptation, and who knows, but that some of the very Christians to whom Peter was writing were suffering under the terrible reign of terror of Nero. It would be very easy under that kind of situation to question the love of God, wouldn't it? Do you really love me? Do you really care? If so, why is this happening? I mean, you would be sort of cashing in your chips if you had bought into the prosperity gospel, wouldn't you? You would be wondering if what you had been told was in fact true, if somebody came to you and said, Jesus wants to make you healthy, wealthy, and prosperous. And no sooner had you given your life to Jesus Christ than somebody was rolling your children in pitch and using them as torches in their garden party. And you might be saying, wait a minute, God, this doesn't look like a loving God to me. Circumstances might make it seem that you're not loved. In the midst of persecution like that, the enemy would tempt you like Job's wife. Curse God and die. Haven't you had enough? And so Peter gives us this lovely reminder. Beloved, you are still the beloved of God. you are still the beloved of the apostle. Beloved, do not be surprised. Don't be amazed that you're being persecuted. Don't be shocked that life is difficult. Don't be surprised when somebody takes issue with your testimony. Don't be surprised when you can't get the promotion you want at work, when your employee friends are hostile toward you, when you're mocked, when you don't get what you deserve. Don't be surprised when your neighbors seem to have a vendetta against you for a reason that you can't understand. Don't be surprised. Don't be amazed. Christians should easily understand that suffering goes with the Christian faith. It isn't foreign. It isn't alien. It belongs. Christianity never promises immunity from suffering. It promises, you ready for this? Suffering. Suffering. What kind of gospel presentation would it be if instead of saying Jesus wants you to be happy and joyful and peaceful and solve all your problems and make you prosperous and wealthy and healthy and all of that, if we said to someone, you know, you're in desperate need of Jesus Christ to save you because you're on your way to an eternal hell, and you have this choice. You can suffer forever in hell, or you can become a Christian and suffer here for a while. Because that's the bottom line. Personally, that's not a tough choice for me. I'd rather take a few shots here than endure an eternal hell. But men seem to want to live under the illusion that if you claim Christ and if you name Christ and if you quote-unquote serve the church, God will eliminate all your difficulty, all your adversity, all your pain, all your persecution. That's not true. That is not true. In fact, I think the more effective you are for God and the more faithful to divine truth, the more you stimulate animosity. You become, to those who believe, a savor of life unto life, but to those who do not believe, a savor of death unto death. So, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you. Now, what does that mean? Well, literally, the term is a burning. The word is used for furnace. In the Old Testament, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew, it is used for furnace. In the New Testament, it has the idea of a furnace as well. In the Old Testament, it was used of a smelting furnace where metal was melted down to be purged of foreign elements. So he is saying, don't be surprised when God puts you in the furnace to melt you down. Psalm 66:10, for example, says, Thou, O God, hast proved us. Thou hast smelted us as silver is smelted. God, you did it. It is here then a symbol of affliction, a symbol of persecution, a symbol of rejection that God designs to be a purging, purifying process. Back in 1 Peter, look at verse 6 and 7 of chapter 1 for a moment, because here is the same concept. Verse 6, it says, In this you greatly rejoice, that is, in the eternal salvation yet to come. You rejoice in that, even though now, for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So he says, look, you're willing to endure some fiery trials here because you know it will prove the genuineness of your faith, which will be rewarded at the appearing of Jesus Christ. So the fiery trial here is not just any trouble. It's talking about persecution for your faith, persecution for righteousness' sake, persecution because of the identification with Jesus Christ. But God allows it to come. Verse 12, which comes upon you for your what? Your testing. God allows it to come because it proves the genuineness of your Christianity. Do you remember the parable of our Lord Jesus, the parable about the soils? Do you remember that some seed fell on stony ground? And it went into the soil, and all of a sudden a plant shot out of the ground. But it says there was rock underneath the soil. And the roots couldn't move down to get the water, and when the sun came out, it burned that plant to a crisp, and it never bore fruit. And our Lord was describing the kind of person who hears the message of the gospel, has an emotional response, gives some outward semblance of reaction, but because the soil of the heart has never really been plowed up, as soon as tribulation comes, they're gone. So, this is exactly what Peter is saying. Suffering for the sake of Christ reveals who's genuine, right? The phonies aren't going to hang around. That's why through the years we have always said the persecuted church is the pure church. So it comes for your testing. It's an essential feature of God's working in you to prove you, to purge you, to cleanse you. So he says, expect it and don't treat it as though some strange thing were happening to you. Now that verb, were happening, is an interesting verb, sumbino. It means to fall by chance. Don't think that when you're persecuted, it's something that happened by chance. No, God allowed it and designed it for your testing, your purging, your purification, your cleansing. First, it proves whether you're real, and then it purges the dross out of your life. Persecution, affliction, suffering are not accidental, nor do they interfere with God's plan. They are right in God's plan. Should be common to all Christians. They are common to all faithful Christians. So, the first thing to deal with suffering is to expect it. Expect it. And if you can expect it, you can waylay its initial impact. It's part of God's design. It's the way He proves the genuineness of your faith, and it's the way He purges your life. It takes out all the pride, the illusion of self-control, the illusion that you can control your world and all of its responses. It strips you and makes you totally dependent on Him. And that's a good process.
Breaking you down in order to build you up. That's how God makes you dependent on Him. And as John MacArthur said in closing, that's crucial to keep in mind as you endure trials. Faith Through the Fire is the title of John's current study here on Grace to You. Yes, suffering is inevitable. It's no way to avoid it entirely. Yet, if you are a Christian, you may wonder whether a particular trial is a test of your faith or maybe the Lord's discipline for some sin. So, John, how about that? Can a believer ever know that, discern that?
Yeah, I think we always ask that. Am I going through this trial because the Lord is disciplining sin? And guess what? We could almost always answer yes, because we're never going to be without sin, never. So even the most faithful believer, in fact, the most faithful believer is likely to be most aware of his failures and his sins and think that maybe the Lord is disciplining him, whereas maybe the most unfaithful believer who is living in some kind of open sin may resist seeing trials as a discipline of God. But having said that, sure, any of us as believers could say that I'm suffering what I'm suffering because God is refining me. But I don't think that the Lord expects us to view everything that way. I think we should count it all joy when we fall into various trials, because God is using them for a perfecting work. In other words, it's not remedial. It's not divine discipline. It's not necessarily punishment for some behavior that we continue to do and hold on to, but rather it is a test with a positive outcome. And what's the positive outcome? The demonstration that in the middle of that test, our faith was firm. It didn't waver. It didn't fail. Peter says it becomes the assurance of the genuineness of our salvation. That's why we're so joyful in surviving the trial, because when our faith was tested, it held firm. We came through the trial confident in God, even rejoicing in God, and there is that precious gift, knowing that your faith is the real thing. If you want more information on this and the answer in complete terms, there's a CD called The Purpose of Trials. We'll send it free to anyone who asks. Just contact us, ask for the free CD, The Purpose of Trials.
Every trial you face can lead to profound joy if your perspective is right. Now, this lesson will help you cultivate that right perspective. To get your free copy of the CD, The Purpose of Trials, contact us today. Send your request by email to letters@gty.org. or write to us at Grace to You, Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412. You can also call our toll-free number anytime, 1-800-55-GRACE. Again, we'll send you the CD lesson, The Purpose of Trials, free of charge. Simply request a copy and pass along your contact information as you get in touch with us. The email address again, letters@gty.org. The mailing address, Box 4000, Panorama City, California, 91412, and the toll-free number, 1-800-55-GRACE. Now, let me turn the corner for a moment and remind you about a first-of-its-kind event that Grace to You is hosting in just a few weeks. I'm referring to the Strange Fire Conference here in Southern California. The conference is going to examine the true work of the Holy Spirit and warn of some of the ways that he's misrepresented in the church today. For more information, to see what John and several of the prominent pastors are already saying about this important issue, go to this special website, tmstrangefire.org. That's tmstrangefire.org. And now for John MacArthur, I'm your host, Carl Miller. Thanking you for joining us today. I encourage you to come back tomorrow as John continues unleashing God's truth, one verse at a time, on Grace to You. What's the point of being a model submissive citizen in a society governed by godlessness? An important question that John MacArthur considers on tomorrow's Grace to You.